Couple of points to recap what we discussed in our study 2 weeks ago. There is absolutely no way to reconcile the biblical account, if we accept that it is inerrant and true, with the ages that are given for the age of the universe, the age of the earth, and the age of life on earth. And you'll remember that we noted the universe, typically these are kind of typical figures given. Universe 13.82 billion years old. The earth formed 4.54 billion years old. First life 3.49, that is first life on earth. And then finally man first walking the earth about 200,000 years ago, but hominid ancestors existing up to 4 million years ago. Now, when we look at what the Genesis account establishes for us, even if we allow for some gaps in genealogies and things such as that, we're pushing the upper limits if we talk about 10,000 years in age for the Earth. That is, you know, quite a bit more than the 6,000 and so on that Bishop Usher said, but nevertheless, it is still obviously magnitudes different from the old age that that is claimed. So there are arguments, obvious arguments, that are raised with regard to why we must accept the old concept or old age of the universe. One that is very easy to understand is the speed of light. When you recognize how fast light travels, and you understand that as you look through a telescope at distant stars, and you're able to measure the distance away from the Earth those stars are, then basically you're looking back into history, looking back into the past. And so if you find a star that is 13.82 billion years, light years away, then that means that the age of that star, what you're looking at the star as it was 13.82 billion years ago. That's the claim that is made. Now, we will take issue with some of that in the new material we're going to cover today. But what we did last week is, or 2 weeks ago, is talk about some of the evidences that indicate a young Earth rather than an old Earth. We'll talk about the appearance of age and other things to kind of answer some of their claims concerning old age. But there are some things, some evidences that you can look at which indicate this 10,000 figure that we're bandying about is one that very well could be so. And those things that are mentioned, the five that are mentioned, the population statistics, very simply, that with regard to the population of the earth, that is, how many men are upon the face of the earth, that the creationist figure of 10,000 years is closer to that model as to how many should be there. And by the way, you mentioned it was 1 by 10 to 500 instead of 5,000. I went back and looked at the article. The article that I got this from did say 5,000, so at least it wasn't a mistake on my part. I'm not sure as to whether which number is correct, but we're talking about magnitudes of numbers of people more if you than actually exist if you give the older age of the Earth. And this is a problem that they would have to deal with. The second is the decay of the Earth's magnetic field. That has been degrading. And again, the upper limit of the time span, if indeed the uniformitarian supposition is taken, is about 10,000 years. Beyond that, Thomas Barnes in 73 calculated that the magnetic field would have been so strong it would have been disruptive to the Earth. Polystrate fossils, that fossils exist in multi-layers of the sediments, which indicates a rapid sedimentation rather than sedimentation laid on over a process of millions of years. Hydrogen in the universe, that hydrogen converts to helium. You could refer to that as a degrading in the sense that it's in this state, it goes to that state. But the universe is made up of large amounts of hydrogen, which indicates, again, more probably a young date rather than an older date with regard to that. And then the final is atmospheric helium. And this is kind of a difficult one, but it's basically a different thing with regard to the other helium we were talking about. The reason why helium is in our atmosphere is because of the decay of two radioactive elements, uranium and thorium, in the Earth's crust. And as they decay, they give off helium. Some of that helium gets into the atmosphere. And there is a difference. This indicates that the age of the Earth, if that particular figure is measured, gives the age of about 10,000 years rather than the 4.5 billion that were given before. Okay? So these are just some of these things. Now, these are arguments that are being made by individuals from a scientific background, because I certainly, as far as being able to accurately relate that, you can tell I'm a layman in my efforts to explain it. These individuals have a scientific background. They're arguing these things as evidence of a young Earth. And there are many, many others, but these are simply characteristic of those kinds of arguments. So with that in mind, I wanted to discuss the second page on the handout. And that is, at the bottom of the first page, consider the reality of apparent age. And there's a point that I think is a legitimate point. I know that not every young Earth creationist who has a scientific background is willing to accept this, but it seems to me to be a logical one, and I appreciate the way that Kyle expressed this in this paragraph, so I wanted to relate it to you again. We read it very quickly at the end of our class last week. It said, "It should not surprise us if science occasionally calculates older dates for the Earth due to a concept known as the doctrine of apparent age." One name that's put onto it. But it's simply the reality of the creation as it is described in the Genesis account. That when God described the creation, you've always heard the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? And that's a kind of a philosophical question that supposedly has no answer. Well, there's a very clear answer if you accept the biblical account of creation. That is, the chicken came first. And when the chicken was created, it was a full-grown chicken. Or at least we would surmise that that is the case. For a couple of reasons. Number one, we know for a fact that humans were created full-grown. And secondly, the need for maturity in order to survive would be something that would be an obvious thing. So you have chickens who had the ability to procreate that produced after their kind. So you have chickens first. It's a pretty simple process. But when God created these things, He did not create them. He didn't create the egg and hope that the egg would hatch and everything would be fine, but rather He created the adult in that regard. And I think that's something that's very clear with regard to the creation of humans, which we'll talk about in more detail. Yes.
Just occurred to me, never thought of it before. When God created the chicken, He created the egg and the chicken. True. He created them both at the same time.
Okay.
When He created Adam and Eve, did they have to wait for the fruit to come on the tree? It was hanging on the tree.
Yeah.
He created the tree with the fruit hanging on it.
Yeah.
So they could start eating it immediately.
That's a good point. The chicken had not emanated from the egg yet, but the egg from the chicken, but...
But it laid the egg.
Yeah. That's a good point to make. But anyway, this is obviously, you have an almighty, omniscient creator who would create the universe. This is the way the universe would be created. It makes sense that it would be created in that way. Couldn't be any other way, but it is the way that is revealed that God created it. So looking at the last two paragraphs, this will be at the top of this back page. Back side of the page. This idea suggests that the things God made during the creation week were formed complete and fully functional. How old were Adam and Eve 2 seconds after God created them? Well, they were 2 seconds old. And that's something obvious. And yet they walked, talked, and looked like adults. Even had the ability to reproduce. Of course, they were given that command in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 28. So ask that question. Yes?
Are there any extra hands up there? Are there any extra handouts up there?
Up right here. No.
Sorry. I didn't think it was.
Okay. And so keeping that in mind, looking at that next quote, what about a tree? So God made the trees. What if somebody cut down the tree? How many rings are on the tree? You know, because you get a ring each year. But when you cut down a full-grown tree that had been created a few seconds ago by God, if you were to cut it down, how many rings would it have? And it kind of always goes back to, did Adam and Eve have a navel? They have a belly button. And, Now, that's not a question that we really can answer. I understand that. But there is a reason for the belly button, you know. But they were created, and they were made full grown. So I don't know. I mean, if the tree cut down in the Garden of Eden, it may not have had a single ring at all. But I assume that probably would have multiple rings. And, of course, that's the the point that he makes here. But it would have only been a few days old. So the real age of the tree, the apparent age of the tree is different. That's the point. The real age of the chicken, the apparent age of the chicken is different. The real age of the human, the apparent age of the human is different. The real age of the earth and the apparent age of the earth, because it created a fully functioning earth that would support the habitation of animal life, including that of man, they are going to be different. It doesn't mean it is older. It means that it is apparently older. And so the question arises, when we see that, well, you know, perhaps, and it gets with me, I think it becomes somewhat evident when you talk about that reference that we made to the age of the stars and the lights. God created the lights in a moment's time. And he created the greater light, and he created the lesser light, and he created the stars. And you understand that if he would have created the stars, that the stars that were created that are 13 billion light years away would not be visible to man until 13 billion light years had passed, unless God created them visible to man when he created them. See the point made? What that means is that God has the ability, because he is God, to create the stars where they can be seen no matter how far away they are, invisible. So it doesn't cause a problem for us. And I want you to recognize with this regard that what the scientist, the evolutionary scientist, what he does is say, we can't be discussing God because that's supernatural, and science is about the natural. So God has to be out of the picture. So we have to come up with a naturalistic explanation for these kinds of things. That's one of the reasons that the argument is made that you can't teach creation or the other term that is commonly used, intelligent design, in the class, because that is the area of faith, and we're talking about science, and the two are separate. My question whenever anyone says that is, well, what if the faith side of it is actually right? In other words, that God actually did create these things, then what you're saying is, we can't teach truth because it's not scientific. And so we can't. Well, what is science supposed to be? The pursuit of truth in the physical universe. But they're saying because the truth includes something supernatural, it can't be taught. It doesn't make any sense in that regard to just arbitrarily exclude supernatural explanations from the observation of science. But there is that presupposition, that bias that exists with regard to naturalistic science and evolutionary scientists in that regard, which is why they reject out of hand some of the evidences, because those evidences have a presupposition of a divine origin, that God exists, and they're not willing to accept that. So there is a prejudice against supernaturalism that makes it to where they're very, very uninterested in examining arguments and evidences that might support the creation account. Now, one other thing with regard to this paragraph, and then we'll go on, or this quote is the final paragraph. This supplies us with a problem when we talk about the apparent age of the earth. And this is one that we've talked about actually before, and that is, what you're saying then is God is lying to us. That God is making it look like it's old, and he's pulling the wool over his eyes. He's playing a practical joke on us. I've heard any number of other expressions about that, that he's being dishonest with us because it seems to be old when in reality it's not. And the way Mr. Butt answers this is very good in this last paragraph. He says, some people have suggested that if God made the earth appear older than it actually is, he has deceived us because things aren't really as old as they look. The criticism cannot be true because God told us what he did. Just the fact that people reject what God said about it, are unwilling to believe that this is God's word, doesn't change the fact that God said, I created it, and gave evidence with regard to, in his divine will for us, the age of the earth with regard to the genealogies and so forth. So, he didn't leave us in the dark. He didn't try to trick us. He didn't try to test our faith by hiding from us important information that we would need. He was very straightforward and honest. You look at the material found in the first 11 chapters of Genesis and elsewhere through the Bible, and no one can accuse God of trying to fool us, because he said, I created it. in 6 days, and I rested on the seventh. And so if we ignore his word, it's not God's fault. That's what I like about it. If we ignore his word, it's not his fault. And there is no, you know, it would be silly for us to think otherwise. People who say that God's trying to deceive us, they don't believe that this is God's word and what he has told us. And that's a problem. Okay? So, questions concerning that concept. And again, he calls it the doctrine of apparent age. I would prefer the concept of apparent age. That's just a logical aspect of the creative process. Questions at all? Kyle?
More of a comment. Several weeks ago, I heard a book being described on the radio about Darwinism, and they were discussing the fossil facts and the sudden beginning of animals. There was no fossil evidence of this, and it was really a mystery, and they could not explain the beginning changes in the formation of the animals as well. And I guess you'd have to go get the book and read it and all everything, but I remember they were dwelling on that point about the fossil evidence not being there for the beginning of an animal.
Yeah, the lack of missing links in transition or in transition transitional stages and transitional fossils. That's a problem with regard to the evolutionary theory. By the way, one thing that Kyle mentioned that I can just kind of touch on, I think it's beneficial. Understand that there is a united front because this is a philosophical divide, an extreme philosophical divide that academia in general has toward those who are Bible believers. And this is something that it's not just a matter of you guys aren't listening to science. This is a matter of academics who think that the worst thing that exists in the world is the superstition of religion, and we need to eradicate it. I mean, that permeates especially university level and even has its advocates in high schools and public schools. So that's there, and that's present. So what you have when evolution is presented, when it's presented to the uninitiated, the ignorant student, it is presented as a solid and agreed upon concept that has been pretty much settled, and it's in stone. When you look at, I'll just give you an example that I came across just recently. There are some scientists now are basically saying the Big Bang Theory is something that cannot be justified. It just the data just doesn't support the concept of a Big Bang at all. We've got to look somewhere else to explain how the universe came into existence. Well, those are evolutionary scientists that are basically saying we've been talking Big Bang all these years, and it's not right. But you'll never hear that in high school. You know, when they mention it, they're going to talk about the Big Bang, because that's the most prominent theory that exists now. But that's coming into question, and it will remain the prominent theory and what is established as fact until such time as it's completely done away with and they come up with another one, and then they'll present that as fact in that regard. And that's just a matter, and it's something that everybody does. You present to outsiders a solid front, and then you bicker in between amongst yourselves. I mean, I can say that Christians can be guilty of that sometimes as well. We need to be careful about that kind of thing. So it's not surprising, but recognize that does exist. And that united front is not anywhere near united in reality. It's just presented that way to the uninitiated. Nick, did you have something you wanted to...
I also was listening to radio a few weeks ago, and I can't remember which talk show it was, the one that had Jess, and he was, I guess you call it a theist from what we said. We had to say, not as much time with this, but by the report we did before about Genesis 1:1, and of course, he believed in a higher being or whatever term they use for God, and he said, well, God created time, space, and substance. Of course, that ties in with Genesis 1:1, but then he added, God created time, space and stuff outside of eternity. So I don't know if that's that outside of eternity was fitting there or not.
I would have to hear the context of that because I don't know. That doesn't mean much to me, that statement.
But of course, you also said, you know, like Megan did, it just one thing was off a little bit, there wouldn't be anything here, you know.
Yeah, well, I think
we need all that.
Yeah, I think we do. Now, there is one thing we're not going to be able to get through this if I don't go ahead and go on. So there are a couple other things I want to mention. The specific one is the middle paragraph. I want to emphasize that. The doctrine of uniformitarianism. Now, if you can say that, you're doing good. Everybody can say it, but say it three times real fast and see what happens. The doctrine of uniformitarianism basically is this, is that everything we see now, that's the way it's always been. And because we see it happening this way now, we can extrapolate back in time and make assumptions that will help us to come to the age of the earth and how things got here and so on and so forth. And this is a doctrine that is very, very prevalent and important with regard to the evolutionary explanation of the existence of the universe and of life on Earth. I'll give you an example of how this works. And the example that I'm going to give you is with regard to carbon-14 dating. You've heard about carbon-14 dating. So we have dated this using carbon-14 dating, and we have come across a particular age, and it sometimes is a fairly lengthy age. Carbon-14 dating is for organic matter. Life is carbon-based. So when you hear about carbon-14 dating, you're talking about living things that at one time were alive. We're going to date and see how old they were. Basically, when they died. How long ago did they die? That's what carbon-14 dating is. There are other kind of radioisotopic dating methods that are utilized to date rocks and minerals and other kinds of inorganic substances. And we're not going to really talk about those, but the same types of assumptions are made for them as are made for carbon-14. So what happens is, with regard to dating, the age is determined by a couple of things. First of all, it is assumed how much carbon-14 was in the specimen at the time of death. That is an assumed thing. How do you assume that? Well, you find out how much carbon-14 is in us when we die. And the assumption is made that since that much carbon-14 is in us, that's how much would have been in this specimen that existed long ago. So that's an assumption that is made. You cannot come to an age unless you assume a knowledge of the full amount. Because what we're talking about is there is a known decay rate of carbon-14. It is a radioisotope. Getting these terms, maybe, and I hope I'm using them right. It's radioisotope. So after a number of years, it divides, and there's that much left, carbon-14 left. It's called the half-life. So a certain number of years pass, and there's half as much left as there was before. So if you find how much there is now, and you knew how much there was before, and you know what that rate is, you can count back and find out how long that thing's been dead. But we weren't there to measure it when it died. So an assumption has to be made as to how much carbon-14 was present at that time. Okay? Everybody getting that? Okay, because that's a real dumb explanation, because I'm real dumb when it comes to it, but I'm just wanting to make sure everybody gets that. The second thing is that rate of decay. This is how quickly it decays now. Does that mean that's how quickly it has always decayed? And the argument is made that is the case, but it is, again, an assumption. And it's an assumption that some scientists claim is a big assumption. In other words, there may be ways in which it could be different. And let me just give you a couple of examples as we go down through this. Okay, so looking at the sub-points under that third point, the doctrine of uniformitarianism contends the assumptions are valid. Catastrophism. When we say catastrophism, keep in mind the big catastrophe is what? The flood. Okay? There are other catastrophes that we can look at that indicate that maybe uniformitarianism isn't the best explanation, but the big one's the flood. The flood, most naturalists claim didn't happen, at least not on a worldwide basis. But we contend that explains it all. Well, catastrophism argues that there are many unknowns which may affect the values that are assumed. In other words, when God created the universe, how much carbon-14? Just because there's a certain amount of carbon-14 in specimens now, does that mean that there was that much carbon-14 in the specimens at the time of creation, the distribution of it? Secondly, before the flood, things were much different than after the flood, atmospheric conditions and so on and so forth. There's not much that is said in the Bible about it, because remember, the Bible's not a scientific textbook. But the world as we know it is far different from the world that was pre-flood. There are many changes, and one evidence of that, as an example, would be the difference in ages of men, pre-flood and post-flood. So, what were the atmospheric conditions, and might that skew in some way the dating process? The flood itself, could that have had some impact with regard to the dating process? What about the higher values of the Earth's magnetic field that we talked about on the previous page? Could that have had some impact? And there are again scientists who claim that all of those things could have some effect, which would skew the dates much higher than what they are in reality. Okay? And the same problems, the same basic problems, come with any kind of radioisotopic dating. Or is it radiometric dating? I don't remember exactly. It's a radioisotopic dating. That's what we'll go with. Okay? I actually noticed I said radiometric there, so I probably saw that in an article somewhere. Okay. So, let me give you just a few examples so that you can see there are problems with this. These are really neat ones, and I wanted to get to this before we ended up. Okay, first of all, there have been some microscopic, so very small zircon crystals that were found in Precambrian strata. How old is Precambrian strata? That's part of that kind of circular reasoning. You know, Precambrian strata, the rock is such and such old because that's how old the fossils are. Well, how do you know how old the fossils are? Well, because they're in the Precambrian strata. There's a lot of that that goes on, by the way. I'm not saying it's exclusively so. But there are estimates with regard to the age of the strata, of the Precambrian rock, in other words, that these crystals are found in, that says it's a 1.5 billion years old. So we've dated it. This is the date we come to. But these crystals have levels of hydrogen in them. And again, remember that decay of hydrogen to helium, which indicates, again, that the age of those crystals that are within that 1.5 billion year old rock, they have dated them, the crystals, to be 6,000 years old. So there is a discrepancy there. How do you account for it? And of course, the bias of the uniformitarian individual would be, well, there's something wrong with the way we're dating the crystals. We would say, no, there's something wrong with what you're dating the strata. And that's the problem. I'll give you another example. With regard to the carbon-14, from 500 million years to the present, every single organic remain that you find, organic material that they measure, all of it has carbon-14 in it. They've not come across those kinds of fossils from those eras as they've documented and such. It doesn't have carbon-14, but the half-life of carbon-14 is such, then go back 500 million years. Carbon-14 can't be considered accurate because the half-life, it says, after using their own assumptions with regard to carbon-14 material, after 250,000 years, there wouldn't be enough carbon-14 left to measure. And yet there is carbon-14 in all of those organic materials in the entirety of the Phanerozoic era, which is 500 million years to the present. So, you know, how could that be? Well, if they were all deposited at the same time, as a result of the catastrophe, they would all have some measurable amount of it. That's the claim that is made. The last four are interesting to me, especially. These are the ones that I really want to talk about. There is a highly alkaline hot spring in Yellowstone Park, and someone said, let's see what would happen if we hung wood in that hot spring, mineral spring. In a year's time, it was almost all petrified. You know what petrified wood is? When you see a hunk of petrified wood, basically that's rock that has taken the place of the wood. There's no wood left. It just looks like wood. And what that is through the process of minerals basically taking the place of the organic material. And when you see petrified wood, it's not really wood. It's entirely made up of mineral. And it looks like wood. That's why they call it petrified wood, which scientists say, it's commonly thought that it takes millions of years for wood to petrify. So it's millions of years old. Why is that? What's because it's petrified? Well, it actually can be that wood can be petrified in a very short period of time. Third point, or the third from the last. Australian researchers, this is kind of an interesting thing, were, I don't know how it happened, but they were doing research with regard to black opals and in one particular bed of opal production. You know, so they were looking at it. They found out that opal is formed, at least this black opal there, is formed as a result of certain types of bacteria interacting with the environment. It's something that happens. Opals are formed in a matter of months. In other words, opal is a gemstone. I guess you call it a mineral too, but it's a gemstone. That opals are formed in a matter of months, where, again, the common explanation with regard to the smooth surface of the opal is it's a matter of weathering, and it takes, again, long periods of time. I thought that was very, very interesting. But the biggest one is the second to the last, and that is ICR, is that International Creation Research? I think that's what it is, International Creation Research. Institute of Creation Research. Institute of Creation Research has been doing extensive research from the time of Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980 until today. And what happened, you remember what happened, it was the eruption of a volcano that blew half the mountain off. Remember what happened, because there was it was just an amazing thing. I remember I was a senior in high school when it happened, but 1,000 miles away or more, there was ash that was settling on cars in California because of the eruption, because of what it threw up in the atmosphere, and it was really a cataclysmic event. Well, there was a glacier on Mount St. Helens, and so what you had with this eruption, this basic explosion of the mountain, was the turning of ice to steam. And the cataclysmic event involves that coalescing of the steam into water and all of the functions that come as a result of it. So it's not just lava, not just ash. It was steam and water as well. And the interesting thing about this, over 600 feet of sedimentation that was full of animal and plant remains came as a result of that. In other words, you have the laying down of sediment in layers as a result of this process that happened almost instantaneously in very short order, rather than over the millions of years that are postulated with regard to sedimentary layers in the geologic column. Okay? So what it looks like is very similar to what you see in other places, but it's formed in a matter of days, or hours, days, months, rather than millennia, millions of years. The same type of polystrate fossils are found in Mount St. Helens. Not only that, but the sedimentation, because of pressure and other procedures, it has turned into rock. So we've got sedimentary rock now that was not formed over millions of years, but in a very short time, because it wasn't laid down uniformly, but rather it is the result of a catastrophe. See the point? It's a catastrophic explanation of this. We know it was catastrophic because we saw it happen. We actually can see what happened on this particular occasion. It is solidified into sedimentary rock, and wood is petrifying. So we're talking about within 40 years, petrified wood. There has already been the formation of peat, which is the precursor to coal, which again is supposedly a process that takes millions of years. There has been a deep canyon that was gouged out. Igneous rocks were formed. So we have the formation of igneous rocks, and not just sedimentary rocks, but igneous rocks, and they have dated those igneous rocks that were formed in 1980, or in 1980 and in subsequent time as that formation took place. And when you do a radiometric dating of them, they date to millions of years when the formation of those materials. And again, I understand, there was material there that's older than the rocks themselves, but that's not the point, because that's the way in which that was the case then too. You say 1.5 billion year old rock, well, the materials that formed the rock were already there, but the rock was formed at this particular time. We're dating it to its formation, and that's what they're doing here. And the radiometric dating is obviously flawed. But what we have here is a catastrophic event. And this is the point. Is if you take such a relatively small catastrophe and you extrapolate the same kind of processes that took place in Mount St. Helens into a worldwide flood with the fountains of the deep breaking up and all of the violence that accompanied those kinds of things. Destruction of life, dinosaur graveyards. There is no explanation for great accumulations of dinosaur bones except for water. That's the only way to explain it. Just something that happened recently. A 30-foot-long Tyrannosaurus rex was recently found right in the middle of other kinds of dinosaur remains. And the scientists, as they look at it, they say there's absolutely no way to explain this. No plausible explanation other than the fact that water flowed and it kind of just flowed them all together. You know, just it pushed them all together into one big graveyard. And that's the explanation that they're giving. Or it was a flood that happened. Now, they won't say a worldwide flood, but they say it was a flood, you know, that led to the... But those types of dinosaur graveyards are found all over the world. And that's a good, plausible explanation as to how they got there. So you look at that final comment. A catchy slogan helps illustrate this. And this is one that Ron said he liked, and I like it too. But to form geologic features, it either takes a little bit of water and a long time, you know, the Rio Grande, the Grand Canyon, a little water, a lot of time, or else it takes a lot of water and a little time.
Grand Canyon Lake.
There you go. And so we have a situation to where, you know, the Earth, there are two ways of looking at it. The Earth's really old, or the Earth is flooded, or is the result of flooding. And again, if you consider, doesn't explain all of it, but the flood explains a great deal. If you look at the data and you interpret the data using a catastrophic model rather than a uniformitarian model, and that's the point that we're making, is that there is some legitimacy to the catastrophic model as well. Okay? All right. So we are, next week, going to be talking about different things. If anyone has anything they need added to what we've discussed with regard to creation and evolution, any questions, anything you think needs to be covered, please talk to me after the class tonight or in the next few days, and we'll see what we can do. But other than that, we're going to be going and talking about the beauty of Christ, okay? Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.